All right. So we're continuing in our journey into the beginning of Perek Bet, Halacha Aleph, in Hilchot Deot. And I just wanted to point out one line, because we were sort of getting late at the end there. When the Rambam quotes a pasuk, this is like a rule for learning Rambam, okay? When the Rambam quotes a pasuk, it's not just a random thing. Usually what people do is they want to know the meat of the halacha, and they notice the pasuk, right? But you should know, here you go. Shkayach. No problem, Baruch Hashem. You should know there's a halacha that if you wear a Hasidic kippah, you're supposed to be late, because otherwise it's like, you know, you're not living up to the garb you have, okay? A nachon, right? Breslovers are infamous for being beyond time, okay? did I tell you my traffic story, my Breslov traffic story? No? I pull up to a traffic light, and I'm sitting with this guy in a car, and he's like thinking about Aliyah, and he goes, I don't know, things here are just intense. So like, I just feel like, people here are so different, but I can't put my finger on it, right? So he says, right? And I'm like, well, you know, people aren't that different. I just, whatever, you know. We pull up to a traffic light, we're having this discussion, windows are rolled down, it's the summer, and we get to just, you know how like you're just pulling up to the traffic light and like the light is like changing and you're having that momentary debate, do I hit the gas and zoom through the light or do I just be a good Samaritan and stop ahead of the game? So Shem sometimes blesses you with the wisdom to just decide, you'll make the next light. So I stop at the light, whatever, and a van pulls up next to us, right? But like, right? Like, don't want to waste a second. The doors pop open. The volume cranks up. We hear this Hasidic music. These five Breslov guys get out, and they start dancing. They're dancing, and the guy's looking at the weather. Then the light changes. They jump back in the car, close the door. Right? I look at him. I say, that's the Jewish version of a Chinese fire drill. And we just keep driving. But anyway, but that's not a Chol Hagof. That's just a Izun HaNeshama, right? That's a healthy Briyut HaNefesh, right? So, if you look in the Rambam, right? When the Rambam, we're just continuing. Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. We're just, when the Rambam mentions a Pasuk, he doesn't do it randomly, right? He believes that there's something in this Pasuk, in this verse, that captures the essence of the idea. And you should know, I've watched people do this when they learn Gemara. They just skip the verse. Or they notice it, but they're into the meat of the topic, right? Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov, right? So they're into the meat of the topic. So the Rambam says, right? V'chein Yishayahu Omer, this is in the middle of Halacha Aleph. Be'anashim halalu haveya omrim l'ratov l'tov ras, samim choshech la'or v'or l'choshech. Right? In other words, these are people, right? Remember yesterday that we said that there's a perception challenge that we have in this world that's like it's like a malady, it's like a sickness, that you think that what's bitter is sweet and what's sweet is bitter. Right? So he says, what's the example of this? What's the paradigm of this idea? Is the pasuk that says, these are people who think that darkness is light and light is darkness. Now, you didn't have to choose that pasuk. I would have expected a pasuk that talks about that bitter is sweet and sweet is bitter. Right? Ah, you'll tell me, well, he couldn't find a pasuk like that. If that's the idea that the Torah wants to tell us, if that's the idea Hashem wants to tell us, there should be a pasuk like that. And it happens to be that there is a pasuk like that. So why does the Rambam choose this pasuk? Because the essence of the problem here is precisely confusing darkness with light. Now think about this for a second. How do you confuse darkness with light? Like, I can understand that you confuse something that's bitter with something sweet, maybe. But what is darkness? You know, there's an interesting debate in Breishit. Okay, pay attention to the beginning of the Torah. It says, "Breishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz." What's the first thing that Hashem created? What's the first thing Hashem created?
He
created
the sky.
Pardon? That's what most people say. "Breishit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz." In the beginning, Hashem created the heavens and the earth. Well, Elokim is the creator, so you don't have to say that "Breishit bara Elokim." Although you could imagine that, you know, biblical critics might have fun with that verse. That's right. That first God, first man created God. That's an allusion to, right? But we won't go there for now.
I've heard something like at the Beit Hamikdash, there's the shittim where like the blood like drains into. So like when he first created the world, it's a barashit. You know.
You're talking about a Zohar. Ooh, you're ready for rabbinical school, Josh. That's a Zohar. Okay. If we go deep into that Zohar, we'll never get out. That's a very deep idea. But putting that aside for the moment. Most people miss what's really the beginning of creation. What's the first thing that has to be created?
Time.
Well, time is the result, because time is the measurement of physical movement. So until you have physical, you don't have time. So therefore, before space, before the universe, before the Torah, before matter, before existence. This is a Shlomo Kalbach idea. So don't get me wrong. I never got this till I heard this. So it's easy for me. Nope. This is such a beautiful idea. The first thing Hashem begins creation with, the first thing that needs to happen is the beginning. You see, before Hashem created the world, there was never a beginning. There was only Hashem. If Hashem is, stick with me here, Jesse. If Hashem is, if all that exists before creation is Hashem, and Hashem is endless, then there was never a beginning. Hashem has to create the concept of a beginning. Now, by the way, that's the reason that whenever you find yourself in a beginning, okay, you're tapping into creation. Whenever you experience a beginning, you're tasting the beginning of creation. In fact, that's the reason, right, that every day when you start tefillah, you create, oh, shkach. See, that's a gabbai, right? Whenever you taste, okay, the essence of beginnings, you're tasting the essence of creation. And that's why there's such power in beginnings, because whenever you're in a beginning, right, you're re-experiencing on some level, conscious or subconscious, spiritual, mystical, the essence of creation. And that's also why there's something powerful about creating beginnings. And if you think about it, you can be in a reality that is all beginnings. Because every moment is the beginning of the rest of your life, right? This is the beginning of this moment. And this is the beginning of this moment. And this is the beginning of this moment. It's a very powerful idea. Because when you're in a beginning, what happened before doesn't have to change what happens now. Right? That's the essence of tshuva, by the way. Right? The essence of tshuva, right, is not that I have to fix what was wrong. It's not that I have to carry guilt. Judaism does not believe in guilt. Guilt's unhealthy. Okay? You can learn from the past. You can figure out how you can, but the nature of beginnings is that for now, I can start all over again. You know, you can come home at the end of the day, you can have a horrendous fight with your wife. I hear this happens in other marriages, right? You can have a horrendous fight with your wife, and you come home at the end of the day. My grandmother gave me an enormous piece of advice. Shh. Robbie, you got that echo thing going again. Never mind. You got it. Right? So, right? You're doing big mitzvahs, though, right? So, my grandmother gave me an amazing piece of advice. When before we got married, I took Dorit to England. I wanted her to meet my grandmother. My grandmother was already 94, and she wasn't traveling to Israel. So, you know, I found an excuse. We had a cousin's wedding. We went to Israel. We'd just gotten engaged. And so she went out for lunch with us. And she wanted to have some time with Dorit. And she said to her, she gave us one piece of advice. She said, never go to bed angry. And I thought that was a nice piece of advice. And then she looks at me, she says, no. You promise me that through your whole marriage, you will never go to bed angry. That's what she said. So there's like this moment of silence. I'm not quite sure what she wants from me. It's my grandmother, she's a very wise woman. And then I realized, you know, she wants a commitment that I will never go to sleep angry. I've been married 20 years. I have never gone to sleep angry in 20 years. And if we have, and every relationship has its ups and its downs, that's the nature of the beast, has its pros and its cons, shkoyach, has its pros and its cons, right? Every relationship has that, right? But you can make a decision. You're never going to be angry. Sometimes it means staying up till 2 in the morning, right?
I think it's better sometimes just get a good night's sleep and, like, have the state of mind. And like I personally feel a lot better about things in the morning, usually.
It takes a lot. First of all, just to be clear, I'm not saying that this is the be-all, end-all, that if you go to sleep angry, your life is ruined. Chas v'shalom. And different people are different. I don't know that there's a rule. The goal is to get to the space where you're not angry. What works for you is to sleep on it and go to sleep angry. The Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, Ein ratzin adam b'kaso. You shouldn't try to calm a person when they're angry. So it takes a lot more work to decide not to go to sleep angry, which is probably why if my grandmother hadn't said that to me, I'm not at all sure that I'd be able to say this. But because she said it to me and it was important to me in my relationship with her, I trusted her and that's what's worked for me. But that doesn't mean that it's be all. I agree with you. It's not the be-all, end-all. It takes a lot more work not to go to sleep angry. But how do you do that? One of the ways that you do that is that whenever you're in any space, you can decide this is going to be the new beginning. You had a big fight in the morning. You come home in the afternoon. You can be stuck in the morning, or you can decide you're starting your afternoon. You know? Yesterday was yesterday. Sometimes you have days where you make mistakes. Sometimes you have days where, well, you don't think teachers do the same thing. You don't think we say things, and then later we realize we shouldn't have said it quite that way, whatever. You know? You should know it's an interesting thing. This is an opinion, and you could debate this with me. But in my life, I think it's much easier to ask forgiveness, right, of a teacher or a parent than it is to ask forgiveness of a child or a student. That's just my opinion, but, you know, I could be wrong. And you can practice being a forgiving person so that it's easy. That's a goal to get to. We're actually going to get to that, right? But that's the first thing in that pasuk, is the beginning, the power of beginnings. You can decide. You wake up in the morning, you daven, and you walk away from tefillah, and you have this energy. You know what? Whatever mistakes I made, whatever, and this isn't an allusion to anything. This is just sort of what came up today, right? I guess this is what we need to hear. But this is where we start. We're here. We start today. Let's figure out how to make today a good day. That's very powerful. You're never stuck in the muck of yesterday. What's the second part of that pasuk, right? So think about it. So Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. The aretz hayta tov vavo. It's a very difficult question. How could Hashem create the world, and the world was chaos? Makes no sense. This was a question that came up, at least for a couple of you, when I was first talking with you about a writer a million years ago, right? Because I once met a student who I said, you know, we're going to learn Chumash, and he said, well, I don't know, would I be interested in Chumash? Like, I've learned Chumash already. Like, what sefer are you going to learn? So I said, well, we're going to start with Bereshit. So he said, well, Bereshit, I've done Bereshit twice. So whenever I hear somebody say, like, I done Bereshit, the question is, has Bereshit done you, right? Yeah, I've been through the Gemara. Has the Gemara been through you, right? But I said, okay, so if you've done Bereshit, let's look at the first pasuk. So this question came up. And this particular boy who I was talking to, long before I met any of you, this question just obviously comes up from the pasuk. How could Hashem create a world, and yet the world is tohu vavohu, is chaos, right? And by the way, this is not a question for 5,000 years ago. This is the question of today. If Hashem created the world and everything that Hashem created is good, how can life become so chaotic? Like, where is God when the world is chaos? And you don't have to go to the world of the Holocaust to have this question, right? I mean, this is a question of every moment. And then you get to the third piece of this pasuk. And by the way, what's the answer to that question? Or at least, what's one way of looking at that question? Because I don't want to leave that question hanging. What?
It's not chaos. We just think it's chaos. In the end, everything is that God does is good. Blah, 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 blah.
Oh, I like the blah, 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 blah. That's your commentary on yada, yada, yada. I hear it. That's a legitimate way to look at it. It's not how I look at it. It's not where I start from. I think that's the goal, to get there. But I think there's somewhere to start from before that. Because look, you look at the world, and the world is chaos. I mean, it's chaos. Are you kidding me? We got Hezbollah in Lebanon. We got Hamas in Gaza. We got Iran possibly getting nuclear weapons. And Syria is no great buddy. And we're sitting here, there's no chaos. It's all good. You can get to that space. And I definitely feel like I'm in that space. But that's not where you start from. It's not where I started from. Because what happens when you perceive the world as chaos? And it might even be healthy to perceive the world as chaos. People look at the world as chaos. Does that mean you're nuts? Does that mean you're just wrong? You know, I don't know. Josh comes up and says, listen, my world is chaos, right? So he said, that's just because you're not enlightened. But come learn Torah with me and I'll share the light with you. Does that work for you? There's a stage before that, yeah?
If there's no chaos, there can't be order. If you never have the ability to be unorganized.
Okay, you can take that path too. You know, this way we have freedom of choice. The reason we have evil is so that we can have good. And I buy that as well. But I still think there's something that comes before that. And I think that this is a tough space to get to. And it's an interesting question how you get there. And you could definitely disagree with this. You could make a case for saying that Hashem does not complete the creation of the world. What does the pasuk say at the end of the sixth day of creation, which is not the completion of creation, right? The seventh day of creation, right? Right? Oh. Vayara Elokim et kol asher asa. Hashem saw everything that he made. That's a literal translation. Vayara Elokim et kol asher asa. Hashem saw everything he made, right? And then later it says in Vinei Tov Mod, everything he made was good. Then what does it say on the seventh day, right? Asher bara Elokim la'asot. So what's to do if Hashem made everything, right? Because Hashem didn't finish. There's a lot left to do. By the way, that's one of the ideas hidden in the concept of a Brit Milah. Right? We're created, and there's something that needs to be perfected. It's not quite perfected yet. They've even discovered that medically it needs to be perfected. And that's symbolic of the fact that we come into this world to be partners with Hashem to try to make the world better. Like, there are two types of people who look at chaos. Some people look at chaos and they become overwhelmed, and some people look at chaos and they become challenged. You know, when you have a day in your life that seems chaos, you can either sink in the muck, I'm stuck in chaos, or you can decide that this means that you have some good work to do. Right? That's the third piece of that pasuk. And then you get to the fourth piece of that pasuk. This is just one pasuk. Imagine how much there is in the whole Torah. Right? So, but not one pasuk. It's the continuation of the pasukim. Right? So then it says, right, V'choshech al p'nei tahom. Hashem saw, right? Hashem created the world, and the world was chaos, and there was darkness. Now, this is an interesting question. Did Hashem create darkness, or was there just darkness? So this is a famous machloket, this is a debate between the Ramban and the Vilna Gaon. They didn't live at the same time, so really it means that the Vilna Gaon struggled with what the Ramban says. It's interesting that although we think of the Ramban as a great Torah commentary on the Torah and on the Gemara, Chidushei Ramban and Shas, and we think of the Vilna Gaon as a halachicist because he has commentaries on halacha that are even in the Shulchan Aruch. But they were also both mekubalim. The Ramban has a famous sefer called the Torah Sa'adim, which is deep Kabbalah. The Vilna Gaon hid his Kabbalistic tendencies. They only came out really after his death. But he was a master Kabbalist. And the Ramban says, basically, that if I'm getting it right now, it's been a while since I looked at those sources, so maybe it's backwards, but the Ramban says that Hashem not only created light, that Hashem created light, and darkness was the absence of light. Hashem created a world in which one feels absence, and therefore darkness is the absence of light. But the Vilna Gaon says, no. The darkness of creation was an actual creation. It had mamashut. And it's hidden, just like the light of creation was hidden. Until when? When is that darkness of creation brought into the world? Anybody remember? This is so obvious that when I mention it, you'll realize it's obvious.
The world to come.
Pardon?
The world
to come. Nope, that's mystical. That's interesting. Pardon? Nope, in Pshat in the Torah.
What's the question?
When do I find that if the Vilna Gaon says that the darkness of creation had it was a creation, there was a substance of darkness. Pardon? Well, that's the Choshech of Pnei Tahom that we're talking about. When? The plague of darkness. And that's why you find all these weird commentaries that talk about the fact that the darkness and the plague wasn't just that there was no light, but the darkness held them in their chairs and held them down, whatever. So, I don't know that this is meant to be a literal discussion of whether there was some physical entity of darkness that's different than the darkness we know, or whether, which is how the Vilna Gaon understands it, darkness can also represent evil. And evil can be the absence of good, right? The absence of good is actually evil. All that it takes for evil to flourish is for good men to stand by and do nothing. I don't remember who said that. Somebody here will.
Elie Wiesel, maybe.
Maybe it was Elie Wiesel, but it's a quote that I once saw in Yad Vashem. Yeah. It's a powerful idea. All it takes for evil to flourish. Pardon? Who?
Churchill?
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think you're right. Much as I'd love it to be Elie Wiesel, I think you're right. Right? All that it takes for evil to flourish is for good men to stand and do nothing. And that is the Holocaust in a nutshell. Or at least the beginning of it, right? And that's a powerful idea. If you walked away with nothing else from a whole year of learning but that idea, and you go through your life and you make that a part of your life, and you sit in a room and you realize that something's wrong, somebody's sitting at the table and he says something, and you realize it's embarrassed somebody. And now you're in a struggle on the table because you don't want that to go by, that somebody's feelings were hurt, and you say nothing, but you also don't want to embarrass the person who said it. That's a good struggle. That's the struggle of an absolute refusal to sit and do nothing, or whether evil can actually be substantive, which we all unfortunately know can be, right? So the Rambam here, getting back to our pasuk, says, right, when a person sees that evil is good and good is evil, darkness is light and light is darkness, if darkness is just the absence of light, then what that would mean is that I don't even realize the light is missing. Do you understand? In other words, I'm in a state of darkness, but I don't even realize I'm in a state of darkness. You know, it's like there's a rav, who's a well-known rav in Israel, by the name of Rav Grossman. And he's a character, a personality, and he's most famous for the fact that he took under his wing the prisoners. There's a big prison up near Migdal HaEmek in the Galil where he has his yeshuv, and he would go to the prison and learn Torah with these guys. I mean, this is a serious prison. I mean, convicted rapists and con artists and thieves, murderers. And when these people manage to get out of jail, he takes them into his community. Here's a yeshiva, and it's mostly cons. And he rehabilitates them. It's an unbelievable thing, right? And they become his chassidim. Like, you know, can you imagine that a rav takes in a person who's a three-time murderer? I mean, that's a powerful thing, right? And he was once visiting New York when I was a kid. And he came to Lincoln Square Synagogue, where I grew up and whatever. And he came to Oriskin for Shabbos. And Friday night, you know, at the end of dinner. So he says, you know, let's go for a spazier. Like, I've never been to New York. I want to go around New York. I want to see. So Oriskin says, sure, we'll go for a walk. Fine. So they go out for a walk. And he's walking on West End Avenue. Some of you know New York City. And he looks up and he sees all these lights up the street, right? He says, what's that? And Oriskin says, oh, that's Broadway. So he says, let's walk on Broadway. So Oriskin says, I like not to walk on Broadway on Shabbos. It's so, you know, there's all, you know, cars and traffic. West End is quieter. Shabbos. So he says, well, aren't there a lot of Jews up there? He says, yeah. And Oriskin's thinking, like, exactly. So I don't want to see Jews being Michal Shabbos on Shabbos. He says, no, that's where we should go. So they walk up to Broadway. So they're walking down Broadway. And they pass by a disco, right? This is the 70s. And he sees the disco, and the disco says Disco Shalom. That's the name of the disco, Disco Shalom. So Rav Grossman, who doesn't know much English, but he can read English, he says, Disco Shalom. Is this like a Jewish, Israeli? What's a Disco Shalom? It's open on Shabbos, you know, there are people dancing, whatever. And so Rizkin says, yes, sadly, this is owned by Israelis. In fact, I was able to arrange that all the discos and the bars in the area actually closed on the night of Kol Nidre. Out of respect to the Jewish community, is a powerful thing. So a lot of Jews had no discos to go to, so they came to Shul. And the only one that refused to close was this disco, right? The Israeli-owned disco, right? So he says, wow. He says, well, there must be Jews in there. So Rizkin says, yeah, sadly. And there's a window there, right? And they have like one of these windows so you see what's going on. And in the window, you can see all these people like dancing and gyrating to all this music, right? So he says, well, let's go in. So Rizkin looks at him like, it's Friday night, Shabbos, whatever. Go in. What am I going for, right? So he looks at Rizkin and says, listen. He says, you know what this is like? This is like a fly in a bottle. He says, imagine a fly goes into a bottle, flies into the bottle. And you have a lid on it. And the fly is in the bottle. And it looks like it's dancing. But really, it's suffocating. It's gasping for air. He said, they look like they're dancing. But they're really thirsty for something else. We have to go in. So Rizkin says, okay, whatever. Nasty syndrome, Grossman has a beard, a strymon, a kapata, I mean, the whole gazook, right? Rizkin's like me, you know. He doesn't even have a beard, you know. Maybe a little kippah, whatever. Wearing a suit. So they walk in. It happened to be... Pardon? I guess this is the 70s. They didn't have bouncers. I don't know. And I never asked that question, but I trust in a right guy to ask that question. It's a good question, right? So anyway, it's a good question, right? There's a halacha in Shaolin ala mashal. You don't ask on the story. That's a risking story, right? So they walk in, and it happened to be that one of the band players, the drummer in the band, he used to go. He was a Jewish guy, and he used to go once a week to Rizkin's Wednesday night lecture. Rizkin has this Wednesday night lecture series. He had like hundreds and hundreds of people would come. Most of them were very not so affiliated, whatever. And so the drummer sees Rabbi Rizkin. Like, I mean, guy walks in a kapata and a strimal and a hat at the door, and he's standing around looking around. You're gonna notice him. So all of a sudden he sees Rizkin. So he's like really embarrassed. He starts drumming. So the guitarist sees that the drummer stops drumming. He stops playing. What's going on? The keyboard hears. He stops playing. All of a sudden everybody stops playing. Everybody stops playing. Everybody stops dancing. Everybody turns around and they see, like, it looks like Mashiach just came in the room, right? So Rav Grossman looks at him. He says, no, you have to say something. Rav Grossman says, what do you want from me? He says, listen, I can't speak to these people. I don't know English. Say something. So Rav Grossman starts giving them a Dvar Torah. Pretty soon they have like two separate circles dancing or whatever. It might be less than an hour, and I'm sure they went back to dancing afterwards, right? But sometimes you're in a world of darkness and you don't even realize you're in darkness. You know? It's not even clued in. That's the challenge. You know, it's like at the beginning of Parshat Bo. The beginning of Parshat Bo, it says, Bo el Paro, ki ani hechbadeti et libo vet lev avadav. I want you, Moshe, to come to Paro, because I have hardened Paro's heart, right? And Leman shitiototai ele bekerbo, in order to inculcate, like, the miracles that I have bekerbo, uleman tesaper bo znei bincha o ben mincha et asher hitalalti b'mitzrayim. So that you can tell your children and your children's children that which I have ridiculed Egypt. Okay? It's a very difficult concept. What does it mean to ridicule Egypt? Like, what does that mean? Asher hitalalti. So uncle is there, says, olulut is schok. It's like laughter. It's like you're making fun of someone. Right? So, what exactly is he making fun of? So, on one level, Hashem is basically doing battle with Egypt. Egypt wants to, you know, live in a world of paganism. Hashem says, I'm going to show you. I will show you how ridiculous it is. So Hashem makes short work of the Egyptians, right? In other words, I make of them a laughing stock. There are different types of laughters. There's laughter of joy. There's a laughter of ridicule. The problem with that, what's the problem with that? What's the problem with the Pasuk saying, Hashem says, I made all these miracles. I split the sea. I did these plagues. So that you would know that Egypt has no chance to stand up against me. Like that I can wipe out Egypt in a minute. What's the problem with that? There's a theological problem with that. He hardened God's heart. Pardon?
It says that I hardened his heart so that he would not give in, so I have an excuse to use all these miracles and laugh at him.
That's an interesting question. That's an interesting question, and we'll definitely get to that question this year because there's a totally different way of looking at that. But yeah, it's an interesting question. But there's something bigger. Hashem says, really, this is a battle. Egypt thinks it can stand up to me. I'm going to show Egypt how ridiculous it is. I'm going to flick Egypt like this. In other words, big, mighty God is going to show little Egypt that they're ridiculous. Hashem could show America. America has this perception that they're the mightiest power on the face of the earth. Hashem says, you watch what I'm going to do to America. I'll make small mincemeat of America, let's say. But there's a theological problem with that because that makes absolutely no sense. What makes no sense about that?
Hashem doesn't want to hurt people.
Okay, so that goes back to sort of the source of all good. No, I think it's much bigger than that. I think there's something just simple that makes no sense. That equation makes no sense.
Why would he do it?
Well, before you get to the why
would he let it happen?
Before you get to any why.
I'm saying it's like he I don't think he can show himself like that, like so straight up.
Well, Hashem can do whatever Hashem wants to do.
We're supposed to emulate Hashem, and here is a quality that's not necessarily worthy of emulation, to ridicule.
We could make a case for saying this is worthy of emulation. I think it's bigger before you get to that. You know what it's like? Anybody? It's like Moshe says one morning, you know what? I woke up this morning and my pinky was giving me a tough time. And I decided I was going to show my pinky who's boss. So you look at him like there's something off with him. Which may well be. I have no idea, right? Like, can you imagine doing battle with your pinky? Like, you walk in and Moshe's sitting there, he's going, no, I'm on a strike. So there's something off with that. Because this is as much a part of you as this is a part. What do you mean I'm going to do battle with Egypt? Hashem created the world. Hashem created the Egyptians. Hashem created everything. There's no battle here. This is an illusion. Egypt is as much an extension of Hashem as we are. What's the game? Asher hitalalti b'mitzrayim? It's ridiculous. So one way of looking at that pasuk, which is what Rav Avigdor talks about, is a completely different perception. You ever wonder why this is so important? Why is Yitziyat Mitzrayim so important? You mentioned Yitziyat Mitzrayim in the Shema. You mentioned when you bench. You all of the Shema. Everywhere you look. Three times a day when you daven. It's in your tefillin. It's in the mezuzah. Pesach. Why is getting out of Egypt so important? We are so fixated. There's a mitzvah to remember Yitziyat Mitzrayim Lebriot every single day. And that's why we say the third chapter of Shema three times a day. Why is it so important to remember Egypt? Because at the root of the Exodus experience is the fact that what we perceive to be reality is really an illusion. And what we can't see, the illusion, is really reality. See, if Hashem runs the world, then miracles are only natural. And all of nature is miraculous. Like, what's the big deal if there's a miracle? Everything is a miracle. Everything's a miracle. I mean, I look at the Six-Day War as a miracle. But why is that a bigger miracle than the fact that we're sitting here and breathing? It's only because that doesn't happen every day in our experience. But it does happen every day. We just don't see it. Right? The fact that every single one of us is different is a miracle. The fact that we can take a breath. You know, there's a meditation that you can do. It's a very powerful meditation in which you try to dumb yourself down. You try to focus on that which you take for granted. What is one of the things that you take the most for granted? Breathing. Who here has honestly thought about breathing in the last minute? Anybody here have a choke? Anybody have a choke? Mm-hmm. You ever choke, right? It's a scary experience to choke, right? I once got something stuck down there, and it is a very scary experience. For like a minute, you can't breathe, and you don't know if you're going to make it. You really don't. It's really lodged, and it'll either come out or it won't come out, or someone will Heimlich you, or whatever it might be, right? And it happens to be a healthy thing to know how to do a self-Heimlich, but that's a whole other discussion. But for that moment, you can't breathe. Boy, do you appreciate breathing. And when you can breathe again, you know, you just appreciate breathing. So there's a meditation that Rav Nachman of Breslov used to do as Shabbat comes in. Before he would do Kabbalat Shabbat, he would sit and close his eyes, and he would just try to concentrate on the joy of breathing. Like, what a gift that is, to be able to draw breath into your soul. It's an amazing thing. We don't think about these things. Go to a neonatal unit. They'll appreciate what a gift it is for a person to breathe. In fact, the miracle of breath is probably one of the first miracles we experience on this earth. Right? A child, there's a name for this. I forget the name, the technical medical term. But when a baby is in utero, right, it does not breathe through its lungs. It's basically living in liquid. It breathes like a fish, right? And as it's born, its lungs expand, and its breathing mechanism completely reverses itself so that it can breathe oxygen. And we don't know any other creature that does that. It's unbelievable. So if you think that light is darkness and darkness is light, that's the yesod of all the challenges that we're about to deal with, right? Is you know, sometimes you're angry. And you actually feel good about your anger. You ever had that experience? You're angry at someone and you want to feel angry about them. There's a payoff to anger. Because when I'm angry, then he's wrong and I'm right, and it's all about me. And it feels good. And you feel good about that anger. And I'm not talking about the obvious anger, like, you know, somebody took your iPod and they borrowed it and they didn't realize how much it would annoy you, and you're still angry at them 3 days later, and you look at them and you're like, and someone looks at you and he walks into the room and you're like, well, what's the matter with you? He took my iPod 3 days ago, I'm going to kill him, right? So you look at a guy and say, okay, this guy's a little off balance. But sometimes, you know, you meet people, they become very politically involved. It's a good discussion. If you read enough newspapers and you start to write letters to the editor and you get politically involved, one of the challenges of that type of experience is not to be angry. Like, if you would see what's out there in the press and you would understand what's going on and you know, I mean, you're listening to the French criticize Israel after 8,000 Qassam rockets fell on Sderot, and we finally went into Gaza. It's enough to make you angry. And you meet people, they get so immersed in this, and it comes from a good space. Like, they're trying to protect Am Yisrael, and they're standing up for truth and for justice and for Emet, and that's a good thing. But they allow themselves to be consumed by anger. I've met people like this. And they become so consumed by anger, they become angry people. And you look at a person like that, and they think that anger is good. It's not good. It poisons your soul. But they're so convinced that anger is good that they think it's light when really it's darkness. In order to begin to move into a healthier space in life, you first have to be able to see what's light and what's darkness. You may think that being stingy is good because it saves money. But if you're so stingy that you won't take your wife on a date, something's off. But if you don't think that's off, you're never going to fix it. In fact, one of the values of learning Hilchot Deot is discovering a recipe for what balance really could be. And that's what takes you to the next halacha, which is how to fix it. And that's what Bezrat Hashem will get into tomorrow. So how do you fix this? Okay, so that's a little food for thought to be continued. I want to give you an exercise for the day. Okay, it's not homework, it's just a thing to think about. Think about something in your life, anything, that you could imagine one could perceive as light that's really darkness. Something that you think is really positive, but if you stop to think about it, you could imagine that somebody would think that this is not positive, right? Think about something like that, and maybe we'll get to talk about it tomorrow.